If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver 3 essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
It's not just historians, it's the grey-haired suited men,
yeah,
as the model of authority. And then you look at these women on television and they're all interesting, they're different, they're quirky, and I think increasingly that's what people want.
That was Anna Whitelock talking about women historians on TV.
An equality in how we express, describe and put history out there, whether it's academically or in a popular sense, tell the whole story.
And that was Joanne Fletcher on the inclusion of women in historical narratives.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to our fifth podcast of March 2017. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. A few weeks ago, the history social media community was abuzz with a discussion about the role of women in history magazines, and indeed popular history more generally. It's a subject that we wanted to explore more fully, and so we convened a panel of experts to discuss some of the issues that had been raised. Our four historians were Fern Riddell, Yanina Ramirez, Joanne Fletcher and Anna Whitelock. And putting the questions to them was our website assistant, Ellie Cawthorne.
My name's Fern Riddell and I'm a cultural historian specialising in sex and suffrage.
I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez and I'm an Oxford art historian, a writer and a broadcaster.
I'm Professor Joanne Fletcher at the University of York and I'm an Egyptologist.
And I'm Dr. Anna Whitelock from Royal Holloway University of London and I'm a royal historian, a historian of early modern history too.
Starting very broad, as experts who've had years of experience working in history, what do you think are some of the main challenges that women working in both academic or public history at the moment face in 2017?
Actually, I think the challenges are the same as they've always been for women, in as much as I think, well, I'm a mother, and I think that that has had a big impact on how much time I can work, how much I can justify being away doing big projects. But I think that actually things are changing and there's a lot more in place to make that better. So, you know, I couldn't have had this job. I couldn't do what I'm doing now at any other time, as far as I can see. Social media really helps, so being able to reach out and talk to people directly. And wherever you are, if you are, you know, changing nappies or loading the dishwasher, you can still stay on top of your publications, you can still do things. So so I think that's all really, really positive. What do you think, mate? Do you think it's
changed? Totally agree. I mean, from the sort of maternal aspect, it is this constant sort of juggling act. I mean, my daughter's 12 now, but it's sort of, certainly in the earlier years, it was a struggle to sort of do the teaching, the museum work, the media stuff, write the books, and yet you had to do that if you wanted to progress. And I think that is still very much underestimated, this idea that women should be able to do it all so easily. And it's just not been a level playing field at all.
I think there's also an emotional aspect too, I think, because I think that there's that element of being, I mean, this is something, Fern, that you're at the process of finishing your PhD, but there's an awful lot of self-doubt and anxiety that comes with being a female academic.
Yeah.
That you need to be everything, you need to get the job, you need to make the money, you need to be the best, and you're really hard on ourselves.
I think you are, and I think one of the, I mean, I'm single and I don't have kids. And I look at the struggles that my contemporaries who are PhD students who have come into it, having been wives and are sort of being mothers. And we all have our own struggles. We all have things that that mean that you look at your life as women in academia and wonder, is this harder for me? Because, and it's hard for everyone, I think, when you're looking at this, what the stresses and strains of academia can really put on someone.
Yeah, and I don't think that's necessarily kind of gender specific in lots of ways. I mean, I think obviously in all walks of life now, men are playing a greater role in terms of child caring and so on. But I mean, in my experience, actually, I mean, you know, I just think women are harder on themselves and expect more of themselves. Perhaps other people, whether it's in academic departments or the kind of wider media, expect more of women. But I know some excellent women. I mean, you know, young women, young academics that are now getting jobs are all singing and all dancing. Actually, you know, they are highly accomplished in terms of teaching, in terms of their research profile, in terms of publications. They're also good administrators. They want to have a public profile. They are incredible at juggling things. And actually, I mean, I suppose I would want to kind of add the kind of positive thing, which is, although there are these kind of struggles and challenges, I know loads of women who are, you know, exceeding those expectations and flying. And actually, I mean, in academic departments, it becomes a bit of a vicious circle, because if you're too efficient and you're too good at things, then people want
everything.
To do. Yeah. And I think one of the things that women are good at, and whether it's because they have child caring responsibilities and other kind of responsibilities, they are good at juggling things. And actually, you are, you know, you can be loading the dishwasher and tweeting, or, you know, just do, you know, being walking on the street and doing emails as I do, which is really bad. And all of that kind of thing. And I think women are just good at it. But the problem with that is there tend to be those people, individuals, women tend to be the ones who are looked to take on positions of responsibility in academic departments. And so, you know, in a way, it's a kind of problem of being accomplished and successful, I think.
It comes down to drive a lot of the time. I mean, I think as a woman growing up in the world I did, and yeah, come from immigrant stock and had very, you know, didn't have much of a privileged background. And so everything I've got has been graft and desire that's got me there. And when you add kids into the mix and all that stress, actually it makes me more productive, more focused, more driven with every minute I've got, and I try to be better with it.
You know. Do you think that's because we have to push to do everything to be taken more seriously? Because that's one of the things that, as a PhD student, looking at all the big named academics that I see, they are, you know, they're professors at 35, 40, they've got kids, they're publishing all these books, they're doing it, and they're juggling everything. And you look at, say, a male peer, a male academic in the same position, and it's not that things come easier, but there doesn't seem to be the same pressure to be shown that you can do absolutely everything.
Mm. And you're judged very differently because you're doing all this juggling and you've got to excel at this or this or that. and they will still find the chink in your armour, the stick to beat you with. In my case, it's never been because I'm female, because there's a far bigger elephant in the room, because I'm from the north and I have an accent. Who knew? Even now they use that. Oh, she's from Barnsley. She's doing that subject. Oh, she's a bit stupid, isn't she? And I get that attitude.
Do you think that
drives me crazy. The north-south divide, the snobbery.
Do you think if you're a northern man, it would be the same?
It would be somewhat easier. It would be somewhat easier. But I just present them with this wonderful package of, oh, which one shall we pick off first? and sadly, a lot of the flack, shall I say, has come from, shall we call them, more established female Egyptologists who have got there and who are certainly not wanting anybody else up that career ladder after them. And so the big guns come out and it's bang, bang, bang. Wrong class, darling, you know. So you just think, well, I can either agree and just go back and, you know, be all, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to intrude in your subject. Or you can just go, you know what?
You say that you have faced some backlash because you're a PhD student. But do you think that women are arguably, who are doing these amazing PhDs or have these incredible academic careers, are more reluctant to go into the public eye because they're women or not at all? Do you think they're underrepresented? Do you think
I think there's some really awkward issues to address when it comes to the role of women in television in particular. I started doing TV. It was a complete accident. Someone actually Google searched Anglo-Saxon art and my name came up. And then, you know, six years later, I'm still making TV programmes. But when I first went on, I was given no preparation. So I made this little film, Treasures of the Anglo-Saxons. We didn't think anyone would watch it. It ended up going out to about 3 million people and it did really well. But the next, I had no training, didn't know what I was doing. And when it came out that day, I didn't have Twitter, I didn't have any sort of social media platform, didn't have a website. There was my mum started Googling my name online, and the hate comments that were coming through were unbelievably destructive. My mum was just like, don't read them, don't read them. But of course, I'm going to read them then. Yeah. And it's all based on appearance. It was all, you know, she looks awful in that. She's obviously not the first to the salad bar, you know, really nasty personal comments. And I this is something you said earlier, Jo. There were two ways to go with that. Immediately afterwards, I just got under the duvet. I was like, I hate myself. I hate this. I don't know what I've done. Why am I doing this? And then I just pulled the covers down and went, right, let's get on with it. And if you don't like it,
that's exactly it. I mean, I don't do Twitter. I don't even have a proper phone. I can't do, you know, I don't even text people. I just do my own thing. People like it. People don't like it. They say horrible things. Yeah. And then you say, it's like AA Girl, Mary Beard. I always remember that. And it's the vitriol that women of Mary's calibre presenting these amazing programmes that so many people like, and you get a handful of insecure men who can't cope with this.
Yeah.
And they start, and the men who were putting it out there in the public arena, I looked at images of all of them and thought, well, I don't quite get where you're coming from. Is this a level playing field?
I mean, you know, if you think about the sort of origins of TV history, I mean, it started off with, you know, J.P. Taylor. It was all about war. It was a kind of male preserve, not just in terms of like the men on television were the historians, but also the topics that they covered were kind of male, typically male preserves. And then you had, you know, when I was kind of sort of doing my PhD and I was supervised by David Starkey, who at that point was kind of doing all his stuff. And I suppose, again, I had a decision. I was either going to go, oh, look, you have to be a David Starkey to be on TV. Or I was going, oh, but I want to have some of that. And I kind of, some of what, you know, I'm researching is as interesting as that. And so, you know, in a way, I just decided, you know, why not? But I actually think, yeah. And so, you know, he was on telly at the time and Sharma was on TV and they're kind of almost interchangeable. I mean, you know, they're kind of grey hair. Just middle-aged, grey-haired men. Actually, they're more
than
middle-aged
now. Give me Sharma any day.
You know, and I genuinely believe that we're in a moment of transition. And I think because for good or for ill, women on TV do have to kind of have a look and have to kind of justify their existence, both in terms of their expertise, but also, you know, why they, what their look is, what their kind of USP is. And actually, we can broaden this out, and it's not just historians. It's the grey-haired, suited men as the model of authority. And then you look at these women on television, and they're all interesting, they're different, they're quirky, And I think increasingly that's what people want.
I think guys are going that way too. I think that's really interesting that you made that point, because I think there's something really exciting happening, which is actually about identity now. And I think maybe you could call it a postmodern explosion, but since the social media things have been happening over the last 10 years in particular, you've got identity. I said it earlier, but it's about strong identity. It's about people who just stand out.
And that's not male.
And that doesn't
female.
Have to be male. Yeah. It's male or female.
It's having the confidence to be yourself. Yeah. And usually people with confidence in the media tend to be grey-haired old men.
Yeah.
Well, they do in politics. They do, let's not start on politics. But it's across the board. And unless we actually do take a stand and say, well, this is us, this is what we do, we've got something really brilliant to share and say, wow, look at this, in whatever field of history in our case, it's only then that other people can follow that, whether male or female, and the same with students, to nurture them and give them that confidence and say, you can do this, just be yourself, say what it is you want to say, and you'll be fine.
So I remember I did my very first TV appearance for Coast, and I was so terrified. I was nervous. I'd gone up, we were filming up north, and I was working with Ian McMillan, and I hadn't done any television, and I was really scared, and I was like, no, I can do it. And I went and threw up in the bathroom five minutes before filming, because I was so nervous. But my university had given me no guidance, because they had no one who knew anything about media. There was nothing there. And so you really have to teach yourself,
totally.
I think.
Yeah.
You have to learn.
Kind of, Fern, you've been involved with the BBC Academy Expert Women programme. Do you think that this, what Anna was bringing up about the fact that women's voices are not necessarily seen as authoritative, is that a wider problem with women experts on TV?
I think we all have to look at our favourite male historians, who are fantastic historians, the Dans, Greg Jenner, brilliant historians who I have a huge high regard for. They don't have PhDs. All of the women.
Like John Romer in Egyptology, he's a giant, he's brilliant, but he didn't come into it the standard way, you know.
But all the women do.
God,
I've been told, Fern, we can have you as an expert, that's absolutely fine, but we can't have you present yet because you don't have your PhD. And you talk about sex and women, and we need you to have that rubber stamp.
Yeah. You've got to have all the bells and whistles. Yeah. You've got to have every piece of armour you can possibly have. And even then, are you sure?
Isn't it funny? Because all these things you're saying, they've been on the edge of my peripheral vision, but I've never really sat and thought, yeah, of course, that's true. And I suppose it's happened subconsciously. Subconsciously, I felt I've had to build my armour up bit by bit over the years and develop it myself. But actually, there is a trend, there is a pattern, and that is alarming. And that's really interesting.
But I also think there's an element. I mean, I think, you know, to kind of maybe sort of slightly cite the other argument, I think now that there's more women on television, and the women on television tend to be, I think, more accessible, more engaging than the men that tend to be, you know, actually, the women on television have also brought forth, I think, a new approach to television history, which is not just simply, I am the authority voice, top down,
absolutely,
one perspective. You know, if you think about the history of Britain, it was the history of Britain, you know, which is great in so many ways, seminal series, but it was the history of Britain, according to Simon Sharma.
You're so right.
It wasn't a multiplicity of voices. It wasn't kind of experiences. It wasn't a kind of braided narrative history, all of that kind of thing. It wasn't material culture particularly. All these things have been pioneered actually by women.
I think it depends what you're presenting and what you're talking about and what the research is. So I work on sex and I work on women. And when I first started, I was like, right, I've got to look really serious and severe because I'm talking about these subjects that people are going to find a reason to attack just because I'm a woman talking about sex. And I realised very quickly that I was worse on camera, I was worse on radio because I was too restrained.
Yeah.
You've
got
to just be yourself.
Well, I think that's the point. Yeah. I mean, you were saying earlier, you know, actually it's not necessarily about the look. I think this is what's the golden age that we're going into, I like to think, where it's about individuality. And actually it's about, you know, and I do think women actually end up, maybe because they're sort of fighting their corner more, they all do look different on television. Because actually, you know, they want to mark themselves out as their own individual.
So you think we've moved past the point where there's a pressure for women?
I mean, when you think of I'm a bit odd in that I sort of work in a specific environment, sort of with an ancient Egyptian backdrop, and I would die a thousand deaths if I had to dress up in a pink frilly frock just to prove I am a woman and be wandering around these beautiful monuments. Yeah. I want the viewers to be looking at the monuments, albeit with my dulcet tones wafting in and out, but to see the landscape, the objects, the brilliant culture we're talking about. I don't want to be a distraction, so it's the same look all the time. No, nothing exciting because why would I, you know?
I was going to say as well about the idea that actually you do maybe wear different hats. I do have different hats. So if I'm doing a formal Oxford lecture, if I'm in the Sheldonian, you know, I will not sit there in my boots and sort of hang out going, yeah, come on, everybody. But then the beauty of social media is you can then be yourself on that. You can let people know who you are, you know, in a load of dimensions, and television as well, depending on what programme you're making. If I'm making quite a serious programme, I made one on Julian of Norwich, which was a really personal story. In fact, going back to an earlier point, I got attacked for it because the opening sequence, myself and the director decided to have my kids in it. And the opening scene is me with the, getting the kids ready for school and then going out on this pilgrimage. It's supposed to be a journey, but it was this idea of, oh, look, mum showing that she's a woman, right? It's from the very beginning. Oh, we don't want to know about her and her babies. But the truth is that that was me showing an aspect of myself. And I think that depending on what you're making and who you're talking to and what audience you're speaking to, you adapt yourself slightly to speak to them. It's basic teaching techniques, isn't it, that you teach to your audience? But I think that that's also comes from being confident and not caring what people think about you. I don't care what people think about me. And if good stuff comes my way, I'm really happy. But, otherwise, it gets too personal.
Yeah, because if you all you're bothered about is getting that shot of that temple at sunset or that fantastic tomb scene, you're all working towards that end. And you just completely forget yourself.
Yeah,
it's important. You're on it mentally, you know, verbally, but in, you know how you look. As long as you don't look like a complete wreck, and well, but you know, as long as you're there to do your job to present that information, that's it.
So wonderful. Moving on to print media, working for BBC History Magazine, I've found over the last year that I've been there that we get way more article pictures from men. We get hundreds of books sent to us for review, and you can't deny that the majority of them are from men. Why do you think that might be?
I can tell you one fact for why I think more men are writing than women, and that is purely time. Because again, when I had my kids, I kept everything going. I kept my teaching job, kept some money coming in. I would do the TV because I could go away for a few days, kids could go to the grandparents, and then I would make some money, put it back into the house pot. But the thing that went from the minute, you know, my baby was born was my writing, because I couldn't get that sustained time. I couldn't sit down at a computer and write a book because I couldn't clear my head enough. I was juggling so many things. And to write, you have to have that sense of, I'm going to start at this point, I'm going to continue, and I'm going to finish. Yeah. And it wasn't until my children were at school where I was able to carve out those 6 hours a day to sit and write that I was able to publish books. And I think men have the opportunity, even if they're fathers, to say, I have to go and write now, so I'm going to go to my study and I'm going to write that book that I need to write.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. I did a biography of Nefertiti. It took me a year. Then I had my daughter. My next book was a biography of Cleopatra. It took 5 years because you just can't focus, you know. And I wouldn't have had it any other way, but it was very frustrating.
I mean, I also think, though, I think it's worth saying, obviously, you know, Ellie was talking about books that have come her way into the, you know, BBC History Magazine office over the last year, particularly. I mean, you know, there has been anniversary of the First World War going on, which has, I mean, I was on reviewing a history prize a couple of years ago for the sort of, you know, for 2014. And, you know, the books that were sent, so many of them were books on the war, military books, and so many of them, you know, men tend to write still books about the war, military books. And the books that, you know, traditionally sell in huge numbers. I mean, you know, there's a few people who sell really huge numbers of history books, and people like Anthony Beaver, you know, that's one of them. And Ben McIntyre and people like that. So I'd like to think that in part it's because of the First World War phenomenon. I mean, it's also important to say that, you know, when you talk about what types of, you know, that men are publishing more books than women, we're talking about trade books. We're talking about books that are going to be reviewed in the BBC History Magazine, as opposed to books that are going to academic presses. And it goes back to some of the things that we were saying earlier about, you know, to decide to publish a trade book, you have to be bold. You have to be prepared to put your head above the parapet, because, you know, there is nothing more scary. You know, you publish in a kind of, with a small publisher, it's going to be reviewed in academic journals that most people aren't going to read.
Yeah.
You know, your book comes out and you have the, you know, the walk of fear to the newsagent on a Saturday and Sunday to get the newspapers. And then you open it knowing that everybody's going to be reading and reviews on your book. Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of reviewers,
tend to want to just promote themselves and their own books and their own opinions rather than actually generously review the book. And so often they just score points. And that's all very public. And I think that, you know, maybe women are slightly less up for putting their head above the parapet, being bold, being courageous, writing a trade book.
I think, again, I think social media helps because you get a sense on social media of how much it's like tomorrow's chip paper. Things turn so fast. Yeah, yeah. And actually, that's what women need to get, is a sense of perspective about how they don't need to take all these criticisms or comments or things personally. Wash them off, let it go, and build on it and go on. And it is a very, very hard moment. It took me right up until my 30s before I felt that level of, like, you know what? I don't care what you've said about me. But it is, you're right. I think maybe there is that insecurity about, do I do a trade book and get a bad review? And then, oh my God, my mum might read it in the Times on a Sunday morning. It's just to be bold, really.
Yeah, and also your motivation is also something. My last book was a history of ancient Egypt because I was so sick to the back teeth of every single history of Egypt. Fabulous, though. I've just reviewed a brilliant one in the BBC magazine. Fantastic book. And yet it really struck me that every single ancient Egyptian was a man. It was staggering. And I thought, well, I wonder what would happen if you actually had, you know, all ancient Egyptians discussed and female pharaohs. Let's have a few of, you know, actually tell the real story. And then you do get a very different kind of history. And it was so, you know, I was so passionate about getting this down on paper. And sort of, that's been my sort of the direction in which I've always wanted to go. So, you know, biographies of women rulers and a history of Egypt in which women actually did, you know, did crop up from time to time.
And that becomes almost, I mean, I always feel slightly conflicted about the fact that, you know, yes, of course, women need to be put back into the historical narrative. But it's often the women that are writing about the women and putting them back in that narrative.
Talking,
I mean, I remember
the
first academic conference I went to was, I was writing on Mary Tudor, and it was the Women's History Conference. And I went there to give a paper, and the room was full of women. And I just thought, oh my God, is this what it's going to be like? I'm going to be writing about women, and people and academic conferences are going to be for women, are going to be all women. And I just thought, oh my God, I don't like this. I don't want to be. And I feel really kind of ambivalent about that. The fact that women are the ones that are putting women back in the narrative. And then this broader question of the discipline that is women's history. Because I just kind of feel like that's kind of like, I mean, I get why they're doing it. And it's sort of like, you know, it's like, why have a women's equality party? And I get the fact that you need to kind of, you know, highlight women and separate them. But by doing that, the whole point is they need to be situated back into the narrative. Yeah. And some interesting stuff is now being done in academia where we're having things like the history of the emotions, where actually that's sort of absorbing both genders. But it's like, you know, women's history. And then you have suddenly the history of masculinity. And it's like, shouldn't it all be integrated much
more? Well, that's the strength with Egyptology, though, because it's not unlike the subjects you're all, you know, based in British history. Egypt is, I mean, I'm sort of home free because they were obsessively, everything was balanced, male, female. So how can you tell that full story unless you have male, female? So all I'm doing is saying, yeah, let's just redress that balance. Tell the story. So I do feel like I'm on the periphery of some of this because I'm sort of coming from a different angle, if you know what I mean.
It's
completely different to British history.
I think that's a huge part of it. I didn't want to be a women's historian for exactly that reason. When I started, I wasn't going to be a women's historian. I wasn't interested in writing about women's
history. When you say
women's
historian, do you mean a woman that is a historian or women writing about women?
I mean a woman who is writing about women's history.
Okay.
I didn't want to be a historian of women's history. And I've ended up as a sex and suffrage historian, specifically looking at how women and have negotiated victimhood and identity and everything else. And because I didn't start and wasn't trained in the women's history discipline, I think it does give you a different perspective on where you draw your conclusions. And I think we'd all agree that every discipline has an ingrained way of looking at things. And that is a problem within the discipline of suffrage. I was going to say that I think I come at a slightly different angle again. I mean, I got pulled into a debate recently online where it was Mary Beard was asking why are there no female history books? And if there are female history books, why are they only writing about women? Now, my second book, yes, is about a woman. My first book was about saints, and it was male and female saints, but predominantly male. And I, at no point when I was writing that book, thought I was writing about women.
Yeah.
I was writing about humans.
Yeah. Yes.
But, and I was writing about an idea, and I was writing about something I was passionate about. So it never crossed my mind. It's only later in my career that this idea of being a woman and being a female historian has come to the fore. In fact, I'm a bit like you, Jo. I would just say that my femininity has never held me back. It's never been an issue for me. I've barely been aware of the fact that I'm in a gendered environment, because I would say I've got lots of other crosses to bear.
Yeah, exactly.
Being poor and immigrant.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Those, the back the first, that could go behind being a woman.
I remember, you know, when I was selling my first book, it was very much, you know, the press release was 20-something female historian, you know, gets deal with Bloomsbury. And it was the same kind of time that Amanda Foreman, who, you know, respected female academic historian, she was selling her Georgiana book with her naked, with a pile of books in front of, you know, in front of her. And it was this, you know, and I remember at the time people like David Starkey going, you know, women are just sort of frilly girl, you know, frilly history, women writing about women, and sort of very much their femininity being used to sell the books. Mm. Now, I think things have changed since then, because I think a publisher would not have the audacity to suggest that. And I don't think any woman would do that. And I think, you know, and actually, I'm not criticising Amanda Foreman. I think, you know, whatever, she made that decision at that time, and I'm not sure that she would now. But I do think things have massively changed. I think
just to go back to the idea of women focusing on certain fields, why do you think that has transpired in the way it has, and that we do see a lot more women, as you say, in royal history and social history, but we don't see women in military history and political history?
We do. There are some amazing female historians. There's Naomi Lloyd-Jones, who's a political historian, and Lottie, I can only ever remember her Twitter handle, Lottie Deer, who's a Labour historian, who's got a fantastic following on Twitter.
But arguably, I don't doubt that there are amazing women out there, but
they're not getting the profile in the traditional routes.
I think they don't get the profile.
Yeah. Because, in the traditional
because commissioners and editors and producers don't, if they want someone to speak about economics or politics, they require a male voice, because male voice has authority.
And they don't want to pursue you doing a certain avenue. Like, one of my books was Alexander the Great. I adore the whole subject, the military aspect. We're doing a lot of work with the Royal Armouries on weaponry in ancient Egypt. But again, because it's Egypt, it's esoteric and a little bit left field. And yet we're doing lots and lots of work recreating the weapons, looking at the damage they can inflict and really going for it. But the media has shown no interest at all.
I think there's two... just to respond to what Fermin said, because I think actually there is... it's about commissioning. I think it's about commissioning in the traditional routes. So in the BBC or in television, there's a traditional way of commissioning and making those sorts of programmes. In book publishing, there is a traditional market who want to be satisfied with a traditional approach. Though I do think that we're in a bit of a kind of explosion at the moment, because I think those traditions are breaking down. And the fact that we can go off and do things independently, and the fact that people can get followings without going through those traditional routes, we've just got to see it come through.
I mean, it's not just about, you know, history. I mean, if you look at, you know, across the media, you know, when a voice, as you say, about contemporary politics is wanted, it's often just looked for a man in a suit, rather than, you know, a woman.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, so in a way it's, you know, what news media is the same as, you know, what people look to in history and in experts. And it's, you know, in a way, society at large has to start to change its perception of what authority is and what expertise is. You know, and this is a bigger question. I mean, this is about, you know, women's representation in parliament. This is about women in the media. This is about women in positions of authority. This is about the fact that, you know, all these kind of studies that have been done recently where, you know, little, you know, girls sort of, or little boys have perceptions at three about who's the kind of authority figure and who's not. And, you know, the idea of that women have to have a certain voice in order to be sort of registered as a voice of authority. All of these questions isn't just about, you know, true of the field of history.
Can I just return to the women's history field quickly and say sometimes there is an idea from some people that women's history fields, in inverted commas, are somehow a bit more lightweight or trivial than serious, in inverted commas, fields such as military history and, like we've spoken about, military history, political history, that are traditionally male. Is that something that you've ever encountered?
Okay, I made a series on the Hundred Years' War, and it was the first time that they'd actually bothered to invest in making it on television because it was too hard to do. And I was telling the ladies earlier about it. It was a horrible experience. It was really hard work, but I did it. And my director at the time was saying, you know, are they going to be okay with the fact that this is a woman presenting essentially military history for 3 hours? And you know what? I didn't get a single comment on it. Not one. I didn't get one person say, oh, you know, why didn't they ask that other military person to do it? Because it was a case of presenting the material. And actually what I did was I gave a cultural dimension to the military information. So, you know, all the battles, I could do the battles, I could do armour, I could tell you exactly which part of the troops stood where on the battlefield. But let's have a think about the wider cultural context of this and what literature and art and music came out of this. And actually that was that idea of, feminising the military history. But it was not met badly.
I think what I do is almost the reverse of that, in that I'm in suffrage history, but I study the suffrage violence. So I look at the bombings and the arson attacks and the really extreme kind of almost domestic terror organisations that we see that suffrage was doing in the 1900s, and it challenges people's perception of suffrage because they tend to think it's just women sitting there or breaking a few windows or asking for the vote. And when you actually look at the incredibly refreshing voices that are coming through in the field of women's history, in all fields of history, that are female voices, it's really new, really exciting research that I think challenges so much of the traditional views, because women no longer think they have to fit in a certain way. I mean, I know we've talked a lot about thinking that way, but we are seeing a huge shift in people thinking, well, I don't have to conform, and I can challenge, and I can really choose a very different approach. And that's really exciting.
Well, and also, I mean, I think it's changing the perception of history as not, you know, taking the sort of spotlight off the principal agents in history, which, you know, if you like, they were men. I mean, you know, we can't be all kind
in
of...
In most cultures.
No. I would tell you know, yes, of course. And there are exceptions. And, you know, you talk about the Egyptian cult, absolutely. But, you know, if we're looking at kind of Western culture, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, men were the soldiers, they were the politicians, they were, you know, the sort of, I mean...
They were the historical voices.
They were the historical voices, and their voices are in the record, and they were the ones who experienced that. And I think, though, that as we start to think, well, hold on a second, you know, who was behind the scenes? What was the culture like at the time? And we look at history in the round as a sort of much more of a macro thing, then actually, you know, gender becomes less important. Yeah. Maybe we just have to accept the fact that, you know, whether we like it or not, women are going to be the kind of at the vanguard. Women historians are going to be at the vanguard of saying, actually, you know, I want to know what the experience of women was at that point. But the next wave, which I think is coming on now, which are kind of like, you know, my PhD students and younger students, they don't sort of think, actually, I'm going to be a historian of women. And because I'm a woman, or, I mean, I think they're just thinking, I want to look at the experience of, you know, the 1920s. And they don't have a sense of, I'm going to look at men or women. They're just going to look at people's experience. So I think we are totally in that age of transition.
I think we're in a massive age of transition in so many ways. I mean, I mentioned the changes in media that are happening already in terms of communicating with one another. But in terms of, we're historians, right? And we know patience, things take time, and the cycles of history take time to evolve. But I feel in my own lifetime, such massive transformations have happened. And I think we're poised in the next 5-10 years on yet another massive transformation. Yeah. We have lived through the digital revolution as well. We have lived through an extraordinary explosion of access to information and to voices. And I think now we're realising that it's about content, it's about confidence, and actually history as a subject is bursting out of the seams. I mean, I would probably class myself as an art historian and a medievalist, but I cross into so many different disciplines now. I think we're also smashing through a lot of the disciplinary boundaries, and that's exciting. And I think you're right, and I think it's about, like, now people want to be a student of, you know, the medieval period, or they want to immerse themselves in a much more open way, male and female.
But I think that's something media finds really challenging, in that historians are now spreading out across all these boundaries, because they like to be able to put you in a little box. So I've had she's a women's historian, it's like, well, no, I write about sexual culture.
One thing that's been suggested in order to get more women, for example, on TV is positive discrimination. I just wanted to see what you guys thought about that.
I think, I mean, there is now a move that, you know, I think, I don't know whether it's official BBC policy, but that panel shows should at least have one woman, you know, represented. I mean, I know actually, because I was trying to put together a panel on Europe last year, a kind of public debate about Europe and the kind of history of Europe at the time of the referendum, trying to get some kind of historical cultural perspective.
And it was actually incredibly difficult to get women on the panel. I mean, I wasn't thinking about I need a sort of equal, you know, ratio of men and women. But actually, when you kind of are looking for women to speak or just looking for experts to speak, it turned out that when I wanted a kind of range of voices in different kinds of disciplines, actually, it was the men that were there. So, I mean, I think with all of this, I mean, you know, I think there's a kind of line to walk between absolutely championing the cause of women and, you know, banging the drum. But I also think we've got to be realistic about it. And, you know, I think that there is now this, you know, over the last 20 years, women are pushing their way through. Women are now moving into senior positions. Women are finding their way through into the mode of being an expert. But there's still a massive kind of, you know, group of men that dominate, you know, and the ratio of men to women in sort of expert fields is still very much, you know, with women in the minority. And I think there's a kind of, we have to be realistic about it. And I'm not sure that positive discrimination, I feel uncomfortable about that, to be honest. I think it should be about expertise, authenticity. And I think if, as women push themselves into that roles, then inevitably there's going to be a better, you know, the ratio will improve.
I think we also have to be much more supportive. I think we do have to champion, but the people who have opened doors for me have been men, because men have been in positions of power. Yeah. And the people who have challenged me and tried to tear me down have predominantly been women, apart from Piers Morgan. But it's you know, it has predominantly been women. And I think that that is something that we need to change in the discipline, and that you have to be more support. You have to, because we have to claw so hard to get there, we also have to leave room for others to come alongside us.
What I've noticed is when I did feel quite critiqued at the beginning of my career, and I was looking at who was making comments about my appearance, a lot of it was coming from women, a lot. I would say more was coming from women. So the problem for women on television, particularly when it comes to presenting themselves physically, is that men don't tend to judge men that much on their appearance. Women will be judged by men and women on their appearance. Yes, yeah. So it's double the impact. And often the impact from the female side is cattier and crueler than if it was being directed at men. Also, and we can't allow for that.
If we could finish on a note of how we can, in the future, get more women and girls into history. So is it by focusing more on things that would appeal to young women? Finding more female historical figures that we can examine? Or is it simply a case of making the male-dominated popular history areas, such as war, making them for women and saying, these are for you, they're not just for men?
I don't know the official statistics, but, you know, based on what, you know, students that I have, women are doing history. I mean, I really don't think that's true. I mean, you know, women dominate in the classes that I take, and maybe that's because, you know, I do kind of monarchy, you know, gender, power, you know, maybe that. But I mean, I think, yeah, I'm sure across the sector, more girls do a history degree. So I actually don't think it's about getting more women in. I mean, I think, and this is where I think we have to now stop, you know, when we're dealing with the next generation, we like fighting the cause of women. It has to be, we want to encourage young people to value the, you know, history as a discipline, see its relevance, see its importance, treat them as equals, you know, young girls and boys in what we expect of them, what we introduce them to, and kind of get over ourselves. Because I just feel like, you know, we need to kind of integrate ourselves and not be these kind of women who fight the cause of girls in, you know.
Well, it's an equality. It's an equality in the classroom, on the TV screen, everywhere, in social media, but also an equality in how we express, describe and put history out there, whether it's academically or in a popular sense, tell the whole story. So it sort of filters right through all the layers. And I think in 10 years, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
And
we'd look
about
back and look like a bunch of dinosaurs, you know, like we're all in crinolines, you know. Can you remember when we had that debate?
And I think the bigger challenge is between people, you know, it's privileged and people that are underprivileged, people who wouldn't see themselves as going to university. See,
that's my stance. That's completely my stance. Because I work for a department that always gives people opportunity. It's an outreach program that actually goes out to the people who are less privileged. And I think you're right. I think we've got to stop it. I'm not a big tub-thumping feminists never have been. But I think we're in a very much a post-feminist world. We're not having to write women into the story anymore. We did that. The 60s did that. They were written in, forced in, shoehorned into the story. We've done it. So now it's, as I totally agree, it's about reaching out to people who are not privileged, who have not got access to the information, the love, the passion of history that a lot of us have been introduced to.
History is at its most exciting when it's about everyone.
Yes.
When it's not divided up into just men's history, just women's history, war, when it's showing you the whole diversity of everything that we can learn and what an individual's experience would be. Because no individual's experience is just theirs.
Exactly.
That's all interconnected. And I think when we're our history is at its best, when it's showing everything, when it's really showcasing it.
And also, I mean, I think it's important to say that, I mean, our, you know, discussion of public history has been dominated by history on TV. But you know what? Public history is about museums, yeah. It's about archives, it's about exhibitions. And you know what? I mean, things like the Heritage Lottery Fund, you know, fund incredible projects of people in local communities doing amazing things. And, you know, you only have to go to big or small museums in a half term or a weekend, and there's families and there's kids of all ages going and experiencing stuff. So, you know, we need to kind of, you know, not necessarily take the thermometer of the situation, if that's the right, take the temperature of a situation by looking at history on TV. You know, the number of people that are employed in the heritage and history sector, both, you know, paid and unpaid, is extraordinary. And, you know, you have to, the growth of things like, you know, genealogy and, you know, passion of oral history, all of this kind of stuff. So actually, I think it's a very positive scenario. And when we actually look on the ground, it's men and women that are involved.
That was Fern Riddell, Yanina Ramirez, Joanne Fletcher and Anna Whitelock. Do let us know your thoughts about this discussion on our History Extra Twitter and Facebook pages. Meanwhile, you can read a version of this piece in the April issue of BBC History magazine, which has just gone on sale in the UK. Also in this month's edition, we have articles on the restoration of Charles II, a Tudor dictator, 19th century inventions, and America's entry into the First World War. You can get hold of the magazine in all good newsagents in the UK and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside of the UK, it might still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And if you'd like to take out a subscription, we currently have a great deal available for new subscribers in the United States, where you can try 3 issues of the magazine for a total of just $9.95, including postage. Find out more and take advantage of this offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/historyUS.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Now, if you enjoy this podcast, why not vote for us at the British Podcast Awards? You can do so by heading to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and searching for History Extra. And now let's rejoin Ellie Cawthorne for this week's history news.
The National Army Museum is set to reopen today, the 30th of March, following a £23.75 million redevelopment. The Chelsea-based museum, which explores the history and significance of the British Army, has been closed for 3 years for the renovation. Five new exhibition galleries have been constructed and existing displays redeveloped, with the aim of making the museum, quote, brighter, lighter and more accessible. New exhibits include the skeleton of Napoleon's horse Marengo, the robes of Lawrence of Arabia and the saw used to amputate the leg of the Earl of Uxbridge following the Battle of Waterloo. The museum's director, Janice Murray, told the press, "I don't think that you can understand British history if you don't understand the history of the British Army. The British Army, in many ways, has shaped the country we are living in today." Admission to the reopened museum is free. In other news, a waistcoat belonging to the British explorer Captain James Cook has failed to sell at an auction in Sydney. No bids matched up to the item's estimated value of $800,000. After Cook's death in Hawaii in 1779, the silk waistcoat passed through several hands. In the early 20th century, it was owned by Australian pianist Ruby Rich, who wore Cook's garment regularly, had it altered to fit her, and even spilt red wine down it.
Each month in the magazine and on the podcast, we're running a series called Our First World War, which tracks the progress of that conflict 100 years ago through the voices of those who lived and fought through it. We've now reached March 1917, and here, talking to the Imperial War Museum, is Sergeant Jack Dorgan, describing his work as a coal miner, having been invalided out of the war.
Would the ponies be very tired when they finished a day's work? Or
no, never seemed to. No, I never gave it a thought. I mean, they all seemed so strong, these Shetland ponies. Strong, very, very well built. Very short in stature, of course. We were not allowed, for instance, you see, the working place from the shaft could be a matter of 2 miles, 2.5 miles, 3 miles away in, if the pit was an old pit, had been working some years, as all the Ashendon pits had been working many, many years. And we pony drivers, we used to lie on the back of your pony and let the pony and ride the pony into a working place instead of walking.
That was Jack Dorgan. And now let's hear from Corporal George Ashurst on arriving at a French village that had been occupied by the Germans.
When you took these villages, you met the village with the old people in. Did they say anything about conditions under the Germans?
Oh, yes, they came out kissing us and throwing their arms round our necks as we marched in the road and kissing us and saying bon chance and all the rest of it, you know. And they said, husbands like comme ça, you know.
What, the throat's cut?
Aye, that's the way they indicated it. They hadn't had them cut at all, but they'd taken them. You see, they got without them.
Were there any stories of any atrocities?
No, not really. Not with the old folks. They just bundled them in these other villages, you know, and let them live there. But, of course, I'm not saying nothing about the young women. We don't know what happened to them because they took them away with them. Except one fine young woman. in the village of Nelson, not Nelson.
Nestle.
That milk, you know, used to have tin milk. All the lads said the tin milk come from there, because it was Nestle. And there was one bonny young woman stood at the door there. Of course, we have an idea how she got away with it. She's been well in with the officers, you know. They'd let us stop there. And she was waving to us. And came to a cutting. And he decided to make a little stand at this cutting. A few men, you know, in the cutting, railway cutting. Anyway, he didn't stop us. We kept darting here and darting there until we frightened him at finishing off. He went. And we got the cutting. We got a little dog too. We shot a little dog right through the haunches. It was trotted about, you know, but it had been shot. And it stopped with us for some time, that little dog.
That was George Ashurst. Look out for our First World War every month in BBC History magazine. OK, well, that's pretty much it for this week, but please do listen in next time when we're going to be talking about America's decision to enter the First World War.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.